Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 214, and we are in chapters 9 through 18 of Tress of the Emerald Sea. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing great. We were, just before we hit record, we're admiring some of the artwork in this book, and that was one of the things I was really looking forward to in the Secret Projects. Is they're not just books, but they're also this partnership with these artists. And I was particularly looking forward to this one with Howard Lyon. His art really impressed me when we got to see it at Dragonsteel a couple of years ago. So it has not disappointed so far.
Paul?
Yeah, as Elliot mentioned, admiring the artwork, I just like, probably less than 2 minutes before we started recording, I just got to go look at the artwork for the first time myself. Because I'm an audiobook listener, and so I just, you know, I've skimmed to make sure I don't see anything too far ahead, but got to see some of the art, and it's beautiful. And it's beautiful because there's some really pretty and cool scenes, and those are the scenes I'm excited to talk to you all about. So I'm looking forward to this episode a lot.
We do have quite a bit to talk about this episode, so let's roll intro and discuss part two and into part three of Tress of the Emerald Sea. All right. We board the Oots Dream and then leave it within two chapters of getting on it. Elliot, do you want to summarize what happens for us?
Sure. Chapters 9 through 18 of Totes, as I'm going to affectionately call it from now on. Tress was on the ship where we left, or she successfully got off the island onto the ship last time, but then very quickly becomes a prisoner of the smugglers who she's apparently thrown in her lot with unknowingly. And she's helped by a talking rat named Huck. She's able to escape from her captors because their ship comes under attack by another ship. She manages to escape, runs across the sea while it's in one of those temporary states of non-fluidization, makes it to the pirate ship, boards the pirate ship, is starting to meet all the various crew members of this strange ship. I think the ship is called the Crow's Song. Yeah, the Crow's Song. Mm-hmm. And the captain of the ship, I think his name is Crow, Captain Crow, and she's not a very nice person, but some of her crew members seem to be, so not Hoyt. Well, Hoyt is there, actually, as the cabin boy, and Tress is making some friends and trying to figure some things out, bumps into some people who seem to maybe know some wider Cosmere stuff, and then discovers that some of the pirates are apparently causing them to sink and kill other ships on purpose, where most of the crew think they're just there to collect booty, I guess. Since they're pirates. Yeah, I think that was it.
Sounds good. Let's start with the attack on the Oots Dream. It goes for several chapters, maybe four. And we learn several different things very quickly in these four chapters. Hoyd very excitedly gets to describe marine warfare on the Spore Seas. And though in Hoyd's words, they could have used boring metal cannonballs, but instead they used ceramic explosive cannonballs that throw water at the enemy ship, which, depending on which sea you're on, does different things to the other ship. So that's pretty cool. The Sprouter of the Oots Dream comes down and uses rose spores to fill the hole. Who saw it? Paul, did you see it?
Rose spores?
Yeah. Did you catch it?
Is it actually a rose, or is this a different flower?
That's the color that it's being described as. They're rose spores, like the emerald spores, like they're, you know, little sand.
But gotcha.
Come on. You've seen
this. I must have missed it then.
Oh, man. Elliot, you missed something big, man. The sprouter comes down, and he uses, Tress even talks about it, or somebody does at some point, roseite. The rose spores are called roseite.
Yes.
We just saw some epic scenes with somebody using, I think, this exact stuff.
Okay, I did. Now that you mentioned, I do remember the mention of roseite, mm-hmm. but I didn't remember that being these spores. Which you're right, that's pretty big, because...
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to remember the... So our friend Twin Soul talked about this. And he was all about these, like, aethers and stuff. So is it tied to that, or is it a different thing? The roseite stuff, because...
Well, I'll tell you what I think is happening here, and then Trevor can laugh at us and not correct me. They describe it as using roseite, or spores from the rose sea, but the way they explain what he's doing, it seems a lot like what we just saw Twin Soul do in The Lost Metal. Spoilers for that book, by the way. If you've not read The Lost Metal, now's your chance to skip ahead, I guess. He patches a hole in the side of the ship by pouring water into his little bucket of spores and then using it to make a crystal patch on the side of the ship, and it plugs a hole. The emerald sea spores stop pouring in, which is a good thing, because Tress is very worried that she's about to get enveloped by emerald spores. But Twin Soul was doing the same thing. Think about this. He had somehow, maybe, a repository of these rose sea spores, and it even talked about him having like a tank of water on his back at one point. He had a tank of water with him.
He did. You're right.
And so now we can put a couple things together. If he's got some kind of system where he can dispense these spores in very controlled manners and add water to them and then somehow control that growth, similar to the sprouter who just patched the hole on the side, he can build things with rose ether spores, apparently.
So it's mentioned a little bit later. The term ether spores is mentioned, where it's mentioned along with the sapphire spores, I believe, which we'll read about here in a little bit. But the term ether is dropped there. So Paul, you drawing the comparison to Twin Soul is even more relevant now, because Twin Soul's got his ether buddy, that Silajana, that runs around with him. Yeah, what's going on?
So last episode, I was giving my predictions. Now I'm definitely starting to think those might not be exactly right, and we might be learning something. Maybe we'll learn more about these ethers. I know when it talks about Twin Soul, it references him as like from some kingdom with like 11 lords of the ethers or something like that.
Hold on.
It has some reference like that, and I'm like, this is kind of a kingdom-y type setting, all the princesses and princes and kings and such. Is this the place he was talking about? Because in my head, it could be.
The title you're thinking of is Grand Etherbound of the 12 Kingdoms.
Of the 12 Kingdoms. I don't know how many kingdoms exactly are here, but I would say that a lot of these places we're seeing, or people we're hearing from, are from kingdoms, I would say. But that's also fairly vague. That could be a lot of stories.
His other title is also Raj of the Coriander Court.
And that one had me fascinated when we read that. 12 kingdoms, okay, that didn't mean anything to me at the time, but Coriander Court had me intrigued.
That's true.
And I don't know how many kingdoms are on this planet, but I do know how many moons are on this planet.
Which are?
There are 12, or so we've been told.
Yep.
And I mean, we can put a few things together too. We've been told that the Emerald Sea is made up of spores that come from the green moon that hangs over the place that they're at. So I've already kind of jumped to the conclusion that all these other seas that we're now hearing about, the Crimson Sea, the Sapphire Sea, I think there's even a mention of like a Black Sea, or maybe I make that up.
The Midnight Sea, that's where the sorceress is.
Yeah. Now I'm envisioning a appropriately colored moon above each one of these areas of the planet.
You'd be correct.
There's going to be a blue moon over the Sapphire Sea and a rose moon over the Rose Sea, you know, that kind of correlation.
Hoyd mentions the 12 stationary orbit moons that encompass the planet. And actually, that's part of the Kickstarter. There it is. Kickstarter art is there's a planet with a bunch of colored moons circling it.
And while we're talking about Twin Soul, I want to dwell on that for just a second, because feels like we just got a link, I think, for what magic he's using. But the more I thought about it, the more wild what Twin Soul is doing is. Like, think about the crazy, uncontrolled nature of what we see in these chapters. They shoot water at each other so that these incredibly huge vines go shooting up into the sky. And when one speck of sapphire spore touches the sweat on Tress's face, her entire like face blows off. Not actually, but like her goggles go flying and she's like deafened for a minute. It's like a whole explosion right in her face just from one spore. And Twin Soul goes and does these very like minute controlled things that he does. He can build a ladder. He can build a giant construct mech. There's even a scene, I don't know if you remember this, he sees through a wall by feeding little tendrils of the rosite through the wall, and somehow that allows him to like see what's on the other side. His level of control or ability with this stuff is like 10 times beyond the Sprouter, who just patches the hole with a glob of it against the side of the ship. I think we might know what he's using. I think we have no clue how he's doing that.
This is super intriguing to me. First of all, so I think of all the planets that we've looked at on in the Cosmere, this has quickly become the one I want to go to the least. I think visually it might be one of the most stunning, might be the most beautiful to view, but might be the scariest to be at, because Tress mentions one bead of sweat could essentially just kill her if these spores are around, you know. She's like, and they like use the spores, but also the spores are what's gonna like kill you. It's super, super daunting, super scary. You have to be really meticulous and careful all the time. So I, you know, that's not for me. But talking about this, I did not think this was the conversation we were going to be having. I definitely missed this detail, and this opens up so much stuff of like, this might, given the limited information we have right now, this could be the coolest magic system, in my opinion, if that is really what we're looking at. If we're looking at coriander, also, as a side note, we talked about salt last time. Is there going to be like seasonings? Is our magic system like a chef, you know? Coriander, I don't know if it's that, it's like, that's like celery seeds or whatever, right? Is what coriander is. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, but
it does spend a whole chapter at the beginning talking about how Tress goes and like scrounges spices and stuff to put in her little pies that she bakes at the beginning. Is she magic using as she's putting her spices in her little pies?
Could be that the ingredients, the spices you put in food.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Think of if you get a well-crafted seasoned dish from Tress fed to Lyft in Stormlight.
Oh, dear.
Come on.
Oh, here. Wow.
Come on now. You get some good salt and pepper and coriander on there, and then she eats that. She's going to be flying in a big mech suit or whatever, a big golem suit, granite rosite suit or something. It's going to be some crazy stuff.
I know we talked about this a little bit last episode, but it didn't really occur to me that salt is like on the periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Just that like was my first thought. Yeah.
So now I'm wondering if salt, like as an element, is also. I just never really considered that and made that comparison that salt and silver are both like elements.
Yeah, I was going to say it's because of that, it made me for a brief moment think of our metals from Mistborn, but I quickly dismissed that because on the periodic table of elements, it's just like these are naturally occurring elements is essentially like what's on there, right? Like it's not made up of other stuff. Like it's like a base element. I'm probably still wrong about something there science related, but that's my general understanding.
Wait,
yeah, I don't think coriander would not be on the periodic table of elements.
No, though. I'm lying. Salt's not on the periodic table. Salt is like well, so, NaCl.
Sodium is, yeah.
But salt's also weird when you start talking chemistry, because when you start getting into chemistry, salt is actually like a category of things. There are lots of things that are salts, whereas like table right. salt is what you and I think of when we say salt, which is, yeah, sodium chloride.
Okay. You commenters who corrected me down in the comments that salt is not on the periodic table, don't go delete your comment because it helps it recommend it to other people. So don't go delete it. Just, I know I'm right. Okay. Talking about coriander real quick. You know how crayons have like 112 colors in a box and they all have like crazy names on them? Could coriander be like one of the C's? Could coriander be a color? Instead of like
maybe
a spice.
I could see that for sure.
Coriander. Well, we have to do a quick Google search here. Coriander is like the seeds of like parsley or something.
It's the seeds of celery. No, wait, sorry. Cilantro.
Yeah, there you go. So like I would think of green when I think of coriander, which we're already in the green, see?
The seeds themselves are like a brown, like a sawdusty
brown,
dark, a little darker than that.
Okay.
But the celery, you know, cilantro obviously is green.
So, so I'm wondering if the coriander court could be a location on the planet as opposed to like, referring to a color as opposed to a spice. But
yeah,
maybe that's a stretch.
Could be.
All right, we have a rat. Who had talking rats on their bingo board for something in the Cosmere?
Oh, no. Okay.
This is actually what I want to talk about the most. Can we talk about this for a little bit? Trevor, last week you referred to me as ambitious with my predictions.
Okay.
Can we all just be a little ambitious here for a second? Okay. Okay. Huck is our rat friend, and he can talk, and Tress is like, why can you talk? And he's like, he doesn't say this exactly, but he's like, you know, a lot of people ask that. Don't worry about it. I don't want, like, someone else asked that, and I didn't want to share or whatever. Maybe one day. We don't have time for it now. We get the classic big mystery, and the character here, Huck, in a very jovial, funny way, is like, no, I don't want to talk about it. But either way, he doesn't want to talk about it. So my first thought was, okay, is this just some like, I don't know, some like weird AVR version that's a rat instead of a bird? But I'm like, no, this isn't the case. There's something going on here, and it's either like a curse of some kind, like we might have some kind of like prince that's turned into a frog type of thing, maybe cursed by the witch, you know, something like that. Maybe Huck met with the knight watcher and that was the curse, was being turned into a rat, or who knows. But there's something here though, and it's something that I'm determined that we are going to learn about, and I'm assuming is going to be something big. Maybe Huck is actually a dragon. I said that Tress might become a dragon. Maybe there's lots of stuff that can happen, but I'm like, there is something big going on here with Huck. This is not just like haha funny talking rat.
You're determined to find a dragon in the Cosmere, aren't you?
It's not determined. I need to find a dragon in the Cosmere. I'll be honest with you. It's a need. Yeah. we've had enough mentions and hints from the epigraphs that I think Huck has to be a dragon. There's not many other options.
I think I can't get over the fact that we're almost headed, I say almost because we're not actually, but we're almost headed towards Disney princess territory. That, think about it, every single one of the Disney princesses talks to animals. Everyone. Name me a Disney princess who doesn't talk to animals. I can't think of any. And so here we had our whimsical, silly Disney princess. And sure enough, by chapter, 9, she's chatting up the nearest animal. Ooh, Trevor's determined to find a Disney princess who doesn't talk to animals now.
I was thinking about Elsa. I guess maybe she talks to the reindeer.
I'm going to catch you on a technicality.
The lizard.
Belle.
The beast.
She's got little sidekicks, but none of them are. That's
true, but they're not animals, are they?
None of them are animals.
No, there's a dog, but he's like an animal the whole time.
It's rocky. Rocky ground there. Unclear. Anywho. Do y'all think Huck is a big deal, or is he just our fun little side character? Because while it has been the fun side character this far, I just can't help but he makes a point to say, like, yeah, I don't want to talk about why I'm a talking rat.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if he's a rat who is made to talk, or if he's not a rat who is then turned into a rat, you know.
He deflects every question that goes that direction. Tress is even like, tell me your real name. He's like, no, it's a rat name. You can't pronounce it. And she's like, oh, no, I can try. He's like, nope, don't even try. Just Huck, don't ask questions. Like every time it starts to go towards a who are you, he pretty quickly distracts the conversation.
So I realized something about myself when you asked that, Paul. I realized that I have a tell on when I'm hiding something or know something that I cannot reveal. I realized I look at my own camera on our display. So when you said that, I looked down at myself to see if I looked suspicious. And then it made me realize that I do that every time. So there you go. There's my tell. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there is something going on with Huck.
Do you want my too obvious prediction that I honestly think is probably not correct because it's too obvious?
Okay, yeah.
So I'm still very much in the Princess Bride mindset as I go through this. I'm very much getting that vibe from the story in a lot of good ways. In the Princess Bride, spoilers for that, by the way, go watch that movie before you read this book. That has to be a requirement. The hero, well, Wesley, the guy, goes off, disappears, comes back later in a disguise, and he and the princess, Buttercup, interact a bunch, and she doesn't know it's him. We'd be very much in that mold if this is Charlie as Huck the Rat, and that he's been cursed by the sorceress or whatever, and somehow this is him. And for some reason, he's not revealing who he is, maybe just to watch her. It's been like over a year, right, since he left, I think?
Yes. So his voyage around different princess or different kingdoms takes over a year. And then it takes her a couple months once the Duke returns to set out. So we're like 18 months after since she's seen him.
So similar to Princess Bride, is this the... Hey, I want to see how you've changed before I revealed that I'm actually your true love that you're off trying to save. It feels too obvious to be true. But I've got to get it out there so that I can reference back to this soundbite and say I told you so if it's true.
Is he right, Paul?
I mean, it's awfully convincing. I think the biggest argument that Elliot that goes towards that is, okay, that's a direct comparison to The Princess Bride, which we know this book is modeled after. the question for me is this book going to go crazy and do some ridiculous stuff? Or maybe for respect of the original story or things like that, is this going to remain more calm and be a fun, similar story? You know, if that's the case, if this remains more tame, then yes, I think this is Charlie. I think it's going to be very funny because we're going to have the scenes where Charlie or Wesley from Princess Bride bests all these other characters, but he's a little rat. It would be pretty funny. So I could see that happening. I'm hoping for something crazy because I guess I'm hoping that Brandon would go a little spicier with it than just the more like super direct comparison. But if he does, I fully get it. Like that's my understanding of what he set out to do was to rewrite the Princess Bride in a new fantasy setting with a twist, with a plot change.
So we need to acknowledge the Hoyt in the room. She gets on the Crow's Song, and the first person she recognizes after convincing Captain Crow not to throw her overboard is Hoyt. And Hoyt tells the listener of the story, whoever that is, that is indeed him. He had a run-in with the sorceress who took away his 5 senses. And then, like a chapter later, clarifies those 5 senses. And it's not, you know, hearing, taste, smell, feel, etc. Man, I should have written this down. It's like...
I remember this, and I can't name all the senses to you as well, but one of which is wit.
Yes. Remember
that? And...
It's like, yeah, sense of self, sense of humor, sense of...
Something like that, yeah.
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 And a sense of self is one.
So
might have even been like sense of decency or something like that.
We can talk about the actual curse if you want to, but I'm more interested in somebody cursed Hoyt. Hello? Like that seems kind of not possible before this chapter that I thought.
Well, again, minor spoilers for Yumi. He's kind of cursed on that planet too.
That's true. I forgot about that.
Do we have a running theme here where in Secret Projects, when you enter the story, Hoyt is under some kind of a trap curse thing?
That's a good point. I was thinking back to, I guess, spoilers for the end of Rhythm of War, but I was thinking towards the end of Rhythm of War, when Hoyt loses memories and I assume breaths and things like that. That's what reminded me of this. I didn't know if there's a connection. This is probably pretty unrelated to that. But that's where my mind was going, of like a similar mechanic maybe.
I'm still kind of running with this. The story seems very lighthearted and rather silly. I'm not taking this curse too seriously. It almost seems like one of those things where Hoyt and the sorceress are actually friends and she's played a joke on him. Like that's the kind of takeaway I'm getting, is that it almost doesn't seem aggressive and is more of a practical joke almost.
Sure.
We do, not to beat a dead horse once again, we do know that Hoyt is the one character that seems to be friends with dragons.
So, oh, yeah.
Is our sorceress the dragon? Is Hoyt a dragon?
Paul, you will not be disappointed in this book, I promise.
Oh, man.
I know that at least half the cast have to be dragons from my logic thus far.
Okay, maybe you might be a little bit disappointed. So if those are your expectations, you might be disappointed.
We have at least Tress, Huck, and the Sorceress. Hoyt is a maybe. The other three are definitely dragons. So, yeah.
But I thought Huck was Charlie.
Yes, and he's going to become a dragon to go with Tress, who will also be a dragon. You know, you can't. It'd be a lot. It's a lot more romantic if they're both dragons. Yeah.
Do we do Tears of the Kingdom spoilers on this podcast?
Wow, that's a thought train I had not put to you. Anyway, I will say, having a literal fantasy dragon would be very much in our fairy tale theme. That is very, very common in your classic fairy tale to have the dragon. Even a dragon who's maybe not the bad guy. Like sometimes there's the dragon that the knight in shining armor has to slay to save the maiden. Other times the dragon's a friend or misunderstood. Like there's lots of fantasy dragons, but in fairy tale, we could very much be headed towards very classic dragon.
So Hoyd tells the listener, reader, I'm not going to name all of the crewmates for you. I'm going to call them all Doug. And anybody who I do name is important, so keep track of them. Everybody else, for your sanity and mine, I'm going to call them Doug. What'd you think of that?
I laughed pretty hard at this section, especially because in the chapter where he does that, he says, okay, almost all the crew is not important. They're all going to be called Doug. And then he proceeds to go name and give backstories on about four people or more. Yeah, it's like, okay, so not all the crew is unimportant because we've got names for at least six or seven of them. And then eventually he does start using Doug to refer to all kinds of people, which does seem extremely random.
I do think it's random. It's also funny. He actually uses the name Doug before he explains what he's doing. So there was a Doug who, I don't know, like stepped on her while she was sleeping or whatever is what he says. But anyway, so yes, we have the Dougs, and then anyone who is named is important. And we have two, I think, that are we can really talk about. We have Anne and the quartermaster, which I don't remember his name.
Fort,
thank you. We'll talk about Fort first. He's got a tablet.
The dude's got an iPad.
He's got an iPad. And Tress asks about it, and he's like, yo, I'm really so glad you asked. There was a wizard who gave this to me the other day, and it interprets what you say and writes it for me, and then it predicts my text back to you. And Tress is like, uh-huh. Okay. What do you guys think?
My mind was a little bit blown in that statement because I just have to read this. I think this is Hoyd. This might be Hoyd explaining what it is to us. But it says that the board that he has is Nalfian tech with awakened predictive connection circuits. The amount of Cosmere books you have to read to understand that sentence is crazy.
Let me put a pin in this conversation real quick. For every episode we're going to cover this, I want to ask you guys, is this an intro Cosmere book?
This was little, the moment.
It's little lines like this that I'm like, man.
That was probably the moment where I first started really thinking hard about, can I hand this to a new reader? Was a sentence like that. Because to a new reader, that sentence makes absolutely no sense at all. None. Like you're seeing capitalized connection, capitalized awakened for the first time ever. I'm guessing none of that's going to get explained in this book. So this sentence is just going to fly right over your head. Maybe that's fine, though. maybe that's fine. But when you break down that sentence and you're like, okay, Nalthus, awakening, connection, circuits, and like tech, like you almost need Yumi to be like thinking about that. The amount of, I don't know, it's like 13 Cosmere books you have to read to parse out that sentence and what it means to the Cosmere.
I will actually say, so I think we might underestimate a little bit of what it might be like to read this book without Cosmere knowledge. Because you're right, there's a lot of stuff to dive into with that. But what I'm thinking of is, if you don't know any of this, then it's very easy to see those things. I feel like, Elliot, you and I have done this a lot, especially when we were getting started, is running into all these terms and things and just being like, well, that's just going on the list for a question I have for later. You know, that's just added to the list. Or, you know, if I'm recommending this to somebody, you know, I could tell them there's more than just this one story. You know, there's an interconnected Cosmere, things like that, and they could write that down. Or I feel like you could read that and gloss over it if you are in a fantasy world. I don't want to say that too lightly, but I feel like if for me, that's not a deal breaker, all in all. I think you could add it to the tally of things you don't understand, and being like, wow, okay, this guy just has an iPad, but we're sailboating, you know, right now.
And it's also a lot of
mixed matched.
There definitely is. And I think something I'm really going to want to think hard about by the time we get to the end of this is, what does it mean to, like, what is it? What are even the criteria for reading order? Because in one sense, like, the Cosmere is just a giant puzzle. Like, does it matter which end you start on? You're going to be asking questions no matter how you do it. It's just kind of like, what order are you going to ask those questions? You can do Mistborn first. You can do Stormlight first. You're just going to ask different questions along the way. So, like, what are kind of the key pieces that you need to experience in order? That's something I'm going to have to think about. Because, yeah, you're right. You could read this and you now have a little bit of a thread of, ooh, I wonder what Awakened is, and I wonder what Connections are, and wow, that's some really advanced tech for this planet. How'd that get here? Now you're going to go looking for those things as you keep reading the like, that's perfectly fine. That's exactly what we did in a lot of senses. So I'm going to have to think hard about, like, what drives a reading order.
So what I'll say on this is, I think there's two types of Cosmere Easter eggs, and he puts them both in this episode. The first one is the conversation we had to start the episode, Rosite. If you were a first reader, you would read that and say to yourself, okay, rose spores create like this little crystal stuff, and you cover the hull of the ship, moving on. Or you could have the conversation we had, which is like, okay, hold on, there's this guy in this book, 7 books in a series, like, that we were introduced to this, and if he's holding this and using it the way he does, like, there are so many more questions to ask over 2 lines of, and he used some rosite spores to cover the hole. And you're like, okay, stop right there. And then there's this one, which Hoyd explicitly uses phrases which you may or may not know. And so the first one, if you're a first-time reader, you don't know what you're missing. On this one, you know you're missing something. You read this sentence and you're like, that was not English. That did not make sense. I understand the rest of this book. That did not make sense. So, yes, Elliot, what you're talking about is an interesting question, because, like, awakened Nalthian tech that uses connection with circuits, like, what is that a problem to have as a first-time reader? I don't know.
You might even, the example on the Rosite too is, again, kind of back to that, like, which order do you want to do it? Like, I might argue that the experience might even be better the opposite of the way we did it. Twin Soul was our first exposure to ether spores, apparently, which I still don't know if I'm quite using those terms correctly. Maybe you should read Tress so that when you see Twin Soul for the first time, you go, oh, wait a second, I know what he's doing here. That might actually make more sense than Mistborn first and then Tress.
Yeah, I don't know. We have Anne, who has three revolvers and helps her with her blue spores. And she, the chapter ends with, and that was when Tress's face exploded, which is great writing by Brandon Sanderson. You're like, excuse me?
I want to talk about that super fast before we talk about spores and the canon. That writing style is so consistent throughout this book. Of every chapter ends on like a giant hook for the next one. Like every final sentence of each chapter is this huge, and then the rat opened his mouth and talked. And then Tress's face exploded. And then, you know, it's always some kind of, you know, giant cliffhanger line to get you to read the next chapter. And I feel like that plays into the whimsical nature of the story a bit.
Now put yourself in my shoes trying to chapter split this book.
Yeah.
There's a chapter split coming up where there is a name drop at the end of the episode, like literally the last line of the episode. So I'm excited about that. Blue spores, sapphire spores, zephyr spores, I think is what they're actually called, explode when you put water on them, which is their gunpowder. They have adapted this into their cannons. What do you guys think?
Like I said earlier, this is like the scariest planet ever, I think. Like, it's horrifying to me that if water exists, like, do they still need water, like, to live? Like, do these people still, like, have to remain hydrated and not die of thirst? Like, how do you do that and just be live your life being like, yeah, I guess I can never spill my cup, like, of what, like, ever. Or else I'm gonna destroy everything around me. You know, like, that's so horrifying. So seems a bit interesting. So aside from the scariness factor, it is fascinating. It's something that I'm really like trying to tune into as we do continue to read, of like really trying to figure out how this works. How, like, to me, I'm struggling with, how do you really engineer this? Is there, like, you know, if you looked at a spore under a microscope, could you see like how it might would sprout or things like that? Like, I feel like I actually have a lot of science questions related to this. I think, how do you engineer that? Is this like a similar way of how you might engineer, like, how people engineer like explosives and fireworks? I don't know. Also, the different spores do different things when they react with water, so I don't fully know what to think about it. Like I said, I need to learn a lot more on this.
When I, just as a side note, Tress being like so quiet and genuine and like normal in the middle of like this literally explosive planet that she's living on. When I first read about Zephyr spores last year at some point, I thought, okay, Brandon Sanderson, show me a maritime battle on the Zephyr Sea. I need to see it. I want to see a full-on like 10 ship v 10 ship, like, you're sailing on gunpowder. Show me that battle. I want to see it. That'd be awesome.
Explosive would not even do that scene justice.
But not to go overboard on Zephyr Spores, but if you're shooting one of those ceramic water cannonballs at a Zephyr Sea, it would like launch excess water like over again. Like, it would be like a chain reaction. It would be like skipping stones. It'd be, you know, my brain goes so many places. But anyway, this is a very odd planet that we are sailing on.
I have a feeling it might even be about to get odder because we've got a bit of a pattern going. So we've got colors. We've seen a couple so far, green, rose, which I'm assuming is like red, maybe green, red, blue. We got a lot of colors to go. We've been told there's 12 moons. So if the moons really do correspond to the seas, maybe we've seen 3 spores out of 12.
Yeah.
What do the rest of them do? I actually started trying to think through this. I just threw out some kind of random and silly answers against them, but like, what are all our other colors gonna do when you add water to them and they violently erupt into something based on their color?
Do you think we'll get one that's a little more tame? I'm hoping for one that's not life-threatening, I'll be honest. Like, I just want one that's, it's like, yeah, you could go frolic around whenever it does. It just kind of, I don't know, oozes or something. Comes.
Hoyt says that there's some that are like perfectly normal or normal, and then some that are more exciting. So, yeah.
I did think that maybe like either the like a dark purple sea or the black like midnight sea could be like darkness. When water hits it, like this huge cloud of darkness erupts.
You out of spoilers?
It. Ooh. Ooh. Well, yeah, kind of, almost.
Interesting.
Or yeah, like maybe the white sea, if there is one, is like snow. You hit it with water and just like this like instant avalanche of snow kind of flies everywhere.
The last chapter we cover, the other corpse. Who spotted it? Paul, did you notice what this guy is? Ulam is his name. I think he's the doctor or the surgeon on board.
I remember having something to draw from this, but now I don't know. I don't think I do.
So Tress walks in the room and Ulam says, "Wow, you have beautiful eyes. Can I buy them?"
I remember that dialogue.
Come on.
When... All I can think of is not a Cosmere, or not a Brandon Sanderson reference, but I'm going to add on to my references list of referencing other shows and books and things. If anyone watching this has watched Hunter x Hunter, then you know about...
anime.
Yeah, it's an anime. If you've ever watched it, then you would know about a group famous for their eyes, and it's like a novelty item. It's like an illegal thing, and people try to get their eyes. Anyways, bit wild, but no, I have no idea what this is, Trevor.
So someone in Wax and Wayne comes up to Wayne and asks him to buy his bones after he dies because they're fascinating.
Okay, I see. I see now.
Ulam's a chondra, Paul.
You're right, he is. But can our... We do... I've wrestled with chondras being world hoppers. That's probably why it didn't click. I've wrestled with that because I think allegedly we know that there might be one on Roshar. I feel like that came up at some point.
Waldo, yes.
Yes, Waldo on Roshar. But I don't know how or who or where... And same here. I guess we know who. I guess it's Ulam, but why and how?
Elliot, I don't know if you were there. I don't know where you would have been, but there's been... Somebody's asked Brandon if there is a chondra on Roshar, and he's answered exactly one. There's exactly one chondra on Roshar. And so everybody has nicknamed him Waldo. As where is Waldo? So everybody's trying to figure out where that chondra is on Roshar. So
I actually,
hold on, Paul, to answer your question about timeline, this is after Mistborn Era 2, where the chondra have begun to explore the Cosmere.
Ah, well, that's neat. Good for them. They're getting out of their hometown, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff.
All right, Elliot, what do you have on Ulam?
Well, actually, I had a as I was first reading the description of this guy, I actually was going to go a different direction in thinking about what he was about to be. The initial description we get of him didn't scream Chandra to me. It actually sounded like a Rosharan singer. He's described as having red eyes, ashen skin, two sharp features. I even think it talks about like ridges where there shouldn't be, is like Tress's description of him. And I immediately thought of our singers on Roshar with, you know, I guess the real tell would have been, does he have like the marbled skin colors that they have? It doesn't go that far. And then very quickly after that, it's very obvious that he's a Chandra. And so, but I was kind of excited for a second that I thought we might be seeing a Rosharan native world hopper.
Well, you could be right. He could be wearing singer bones.
Oh, that's true.
That was my thought. Yeah. I feel like this might be Waldo. We may have just met Waldo.
You might. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the implications of finding a Chandra on a pirate ship with Hoyt on the same pirate ship? Seems a lot awfully convenient to find so many important people on one ship.
That was literally what I was about to say, Trevor. I'm like, man, this is quite a stacked ship. We've got a talking rat, which seems to be an anomaly, or maybe that's normal here. We'll wait and see. We have Hoyd, number one leading world hopper, and then we have a Chandra, and then we have Tress, who's a dragon, probably. So this is just one of the most stacked boats, but they're not actually on a boat anymore, that we've seen. So, yeah, awfully convenient, I guess. Maybe we are going in a more Cosmere big scale.
I might be able to stack it even further for you. Trevor, can you answer this question? It's fine if you can't. Do we know how big this planet is?
I can't answer the question telling you we don't know.
Okay. The reason I ask is that we've discovered already that our Rosharans are bigger. They're taller, especially than like Skadrians. If someone who grows up on Skadrial goes to Roshar, they seem short to everyone else
right.
on Roshar, which has to do with the planet size and gravity and things like that.
And just as a refresher, for scale, Skadrial is 1 and 1 equal to Earth.
Right.
So Rosharans would be tall for us.
Right. The quartermaster fort is described as being giant, like incorrect proportions large. I didn't think about it until just now. Could that be an indication of world hopper, that he comes from a planet that's less gravity or something?
I did think about this a little bit, but I arrived at a mildly different conclusion, one that's less Cosmere implication-y. When they were describing Fort and his size, you know, I mentioned, I think in the last episode, the trope of almost like the three challenges that Wesley goes through. I was thinking maybe this is setting up that this is our giant, like Andre the giant. Yeah, exactly. That this might be our big tough guy who's just massive and like does a feat of strength. That doesn't mean he's not Rosharan. He could be Rosharan. I didn't actually think about that. And it is like he's out of place. And they mention like his heritage almost, don't they? They mention it's like, yeah, his parents were some huge people too. I think I could be wrong on that. But I feel like they attribute a reason to his size, not just like he's a freak or something. Maybe he comes from a tall family. I don't remember for sure, but could be he's Rosharan. Could be both, that he's Rosharan and he's going to be the Andre the Giant here. So
what I remember is Hoyd mentioning when the shards made him, they realized they went overboard and decreased everyone else by 10%, is how Hoyd describes him. Interesting that he specified that the shards made him, but other than that, I don't know if there's too much on his backstory.
Is he described, I'm trying to look it up because I can't quite remember, is he described as dark-skinned and having, like, dreadlocks, or is that somebody else?
Yes.
Is it, is this Talonel?
Isn't Talonel
depicted like that sometimes?
That's true.
Yes. Yes, he is. Elliot, I'm so proud. I'm so happy right now. This is the kind of predictions that we need. I'm trying to find another scrap of logic to connect Talonel to this. But yeah, this is Talonel after he gets his senses back.
And
he's pretty immortal. So yeah, it definitely makes sense. He's just trying to go on a vacation, go for a little sailing trip. But he likes responsibility, so here he is as the quartermaster for this crew. But he likes it. It's a nice little humble role in his retirement.
And that's why he doesn't talk, because if he were to talk, he would say, "My name is Talonel Elyn, Herald of War. The desolation is near at hand, blah, 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 blah."
And people would be a little put off by that. So right. He just remains quiet, and that's okay.
There we go.
Solved.
Problem solved. Yeah, okay, there we go.
I should
have and what bigger feat of strength to do than going against the Herald who, you know, withstood torment for like hundreds of years or however long he made it? I mean, if we have a repeat of The Princess Bride where we have Charlie/Wesley coming through, and he's, I mean, I think he'd be toast. Like, I feel like that's just, you can't, you know, beat that, so.
So, what I've learned in this episode is we have Huck the Rat versus Talonel Elyn next episode.
Yes.
Correct? Yes. That's what we're predicting?
Before the end of the book, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm here for the rat.
Absolutely. I mean, he's also a dragon, so I guess it's maybe a little better for him than we might think.
Anything else?
I think that covers all the craziness I have in my notes.
Alrighty. We can close it there. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot. We will reconvene next week.
Fare thee well.
Toodles. I think I haven't used that one in a while, so.
I think you have quite recently, actually.